Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Crossroads of Time by Andre Norton. Narrated by Graham Rowett. Prologue. The office was bare of all furniture except for a seat pulled drawer fashion out of the softly glowing wall. The report, shining in fiery script up at the inspector, was on a desk. Or perhaps those letters only appeared fiery because of the possible conflagration to come, masked in the official idiom of his particular security section. As long ago as his third month in the service, a time now he found difficult to recall, he had ceased abruptly to believe that any operation could run smoothly. In past experience, the most placid landscapes hid the nastiest traps. Now he leaned back in the seat, which accommodatingly changed shape to fit his middle-aged bulk at the new angle. Though his expression had not changed, he ran a fingertip nervously back and forth along the edge of the reader plate on which the message still stood. He had already wasted too much time on this, but... Classified Report. Division 1 plus Information. Project 4678. Nature of Offense. Attempt to influence other level history. Agents. Section Leader. Com Varlt, MW69321. Crew. Horman Tylus, MW69345. Fal Korf, AW70958. Peg Lo Sig, AW70889. Progress to date. Traced subject came out Voprange to levels 415-426 inclusive. Established prime base on likeliest world, E641, marked on survey of call 30-51446, e.g. as culturally retarded, critical, forbidden, except to sociological investigators, rank 1 to 2. But subject may be on another world of this grouping or engaged in hopping. Cover. Have assumed credentials and background of members of native law enforcement body, national in scope. Federal Bureau of Investigation. Type of culture. Don Atomic. Inhabitants on this level appear to possess no psi powers. Highly unstable civilization. Just the type to attract Prange. Remarks. There was the meat of it. Entered under remarks. The inspector's eyes lifted to the restful, unbroken glow of the opposite wall. They were getting all too many of such remarks at headquarters lately. Why, when he had been in the field force? He shook his head and then had the grace to laugh at his own dawning pomposity. The important point was, the man in the field knew. He read the final sentence on which his decision must be made. Remarks. Must term operation solution dubious, critical plus, require extreme powers under 202 classification. Com Varlt, MW in charge. Com Varlt. The inspector triggered a button with one of those nervous fingertips. The report flashed off, and in its place was a series of code symbols. That agent had a rather impressive record all the way along. The inspector's hesitation was gone. He pressed a second button and smiled almost grimly. Varlt had asked for it. Now he had his wish. Only solution dubious had better turn out solution satisfactory. A new report clicked on the reader, and the inspector turned to consider another case. Chapter 1. The window was a square of gray light at the narrow end of the small hotel room. Blake Walker regarded this evidence of another day with an odd detachment. He moved to snub out a cigarette in the tray beside the bed. Then he collected his watch from the table. 6:01. And what he had been waiting for the past hour must be very close now. He pulled his 6 feet of lean muscle and fine bones out of the bed and padded into the bathroom to plug in his razor. From the mirror, his own eyes, tired and dark, stared back at him without curiosity or interest. In the artificial light, his thick cap of hair appeared as black as his brows and lashes, but in the sunlight it would be red, so dark a red as might rightly be termed mahogany. Only his skin was not fair, but a smooth and even brown, as if before birth he had acquired a permanent suntan. Shaving was a perfunctory business, conducted mostly from force of habit, since his area of beard was small and grew slowly. His black brows twisted together now in a familiar frown as he wondered, for perhaps the thousandth time, if he did have Asiatic blood. Only, who had ever heard of a red-haired Chinese or Hindu? Not that he could trace his parentage. Detective Sergeant Dan Walker had brought the resources of an entire city police force to bear on that problem some 20 years ago, after he'd stumbled on the alley baby. Patrolman Harvey Blake and Sergeant Dan Walker had found him, and later Dan had claimed him for a son. But he would always wonder about the 2 years of his life before that. Blake's well-cut mouth became a grim line under the pressure of memory. Sergeant, now Inspector, Dan, going into the First National to buy traveler's checks for that long-awaited trip, running into a holdup in progress. Dan Walker had been shot down, and it had not lessened Molly's heartache to know that he had taken his killer with him. After that, there had been the two of them, Molly Walker and Blake. Then Molly went to bed one night and did not awake in the morning. So now he was alone again, cut off from the only security he had known. Blake put down the razor carefully, as if that motion was a part of some intricate and necessary action. His eyes were still on the mirror, but they saw no reflection there, certainly not the lines of tension suddenly aging his face. It was coming. It was very close now. The last time that feeling had driven him into Molly's bedroom and his painful discovery there. Now it was urgently pushing him toward the hall. He listened, knowing of old that there was really nothing to hear. This he could only feel. Then, with quiet cat's feet, he went to the hall door without snapping on the room light. With infinite caution, he turned the key and eased the door open. He had no idea of what waited on the other side. He only knew that some action was being so forcibly demanded of him that he could not disobey, even if he wished. For one moment he stared. Two men stood, their backs toward him, one behind the other. A tall man wearing a loose coat, his dark hair still glistening with the sheen of sleet, was fitting a key into the door on the opposite side of the corridor. His companion held a gun jammed against his back. Blake, his bare feet making no sound on the carpet, moved. His fingers locked about the gunman's throat, and he jerked the fellow's head back. Instantly, the other man whirled. Almost, Blake thought, as if he had known what was about to happen. His fist swung up and connected with just the right point on the threshing captive's jaw. Then Blake was supporting the full weight of an unconscious man. But the other took hold, waving Blake back into his room, following him quickly, the prize in tow. Once inside, he dropped his burden to the floor without ceremony and locked the door. With a doubt or two, Blake sat down on the edge of the bed. Why so little fuss on the part of the suddenly released prisoner? And why come in here with the captive? Police? His hand went to the phone on the bedside table. The tall man turned. He brought out a wallet and flipped it open for Blake to read the card inside. Then the younger man nodded. No police. The other shook his head. Not yet. Sorry to barge in on you, Mr. Walker. Mr. Walker, you helped me out of a tight hole there, but I'll have to ask you to let me handle this my own way. We won't bother you for long. I'll finish dressing. Blake got up. The federal agent was squatting on his heels by the slumbering gunman, and Blake was knotting his tie when a scene, reflected in the mirror, drew him back to the bedroom. The self-introduced Kitson was searching his unconscious prisoner, and the oddness of that search intrigued Blake. Slowly, the federal man ran his fingers through the oily hair of the other, apparently in quest of something on the skull beneath. Then, with a pencil flash, he examined both ears and nostrils. Last of all, he explored the gunman's half-open mouth, withdrawing a dental plate. He made no sound, but Blake sensed his triumph as he freed from underside of the plastic denture a small disc, which he wrapped in his handkerchief and stowed away in an inner pocket. Care to wash now? Blake asked casually. Kitson stiffened. He looked up, straight into Blake's eyes. And his own eyes were strange ones, almost yellow, unblinking, like those of some hunting feline. They continued to bore into Blake, or to try to, but he met stare with stare. The agent got to his feet. I would, for a fact. His voice was mild, deceptively so, Blake believed. He was certain that in some way he had surprised the man, had failed to respond as the other had expected him to. When Kitson was wiping his hands, there came a knock at the door. My men. The agent appeared as certain of that as if he could see through the wall. Blake unlocked and opened the door. Two men stood outside. Under any other circumstances, Blake might not have given them a second glance, but now he watched them with double intentness. One was almost as tall as Kitson, and his wide-boned, freckled face was surmounted by a thatch of bright red hair, only partially concealed by his hat. The other, in contrast, was not only short, but small, delicately boned, almost frail. They gave Blake flickering glances as they passed him, and he felt as though he had been measured, catalogued, and filed for all time. "Okay, Chief?" asked the red-haired one. Kitson stepped aside to reveal the man on the floor. "He's all yours, boys." Between them, they brought the gunman to a partial consciousness and took him out. But Kitson remained and, when they were gone, locked the door for the second time. Blake watched this move with raised eyebrows. "I assure you," he kept his tone light, "I have no connection with the departed." "I am sure you have not. However, this is a matter which should not concern me. Is that it?" For the first time, Kitson's tight lips moved in a shadow smile. "Just so. We would rather no one knew about this little episode. My foster father was on the police force. I don't talk out of turn." "You are from out of town?" "I'm from Ohio, yes. My foster parents are dead. I came here to enter Havers," Blake answered with the exact truth.
"Havers, so you are an art student?"
"I have hopes." Blake refused to be drawn. "But 5 minutes of checking on your part will support all my statements."
Kitson's shadow smile broadened. "I don't doubt that at all, young man. But tell me one thing. Just why did you open your door at the crucial moment? Elsewhere, you couldn't have heard us coming up the corridor, not through these walls, and—"
He was frowning now, watching Blake with that same hunting cat intensity, as if the young man presented a problem which must be solved.
Blake lost a fraction of his assurance. How could he possibly explain those queer flashes of foreboding, which he had had at intervals all his life, warning him of danger to come? How could he explain to this man that he had been sitting in the dark for at least an hour, certain that trouble was ahead and that action on his part was necessary? Then, moved perhaps by that unblinking, demanding stare, he plunged.
"I just had a feeling that something was wrong, that I must open the door."
And those tawny eyes held his as if they would bore into his skull and lay bare every one of his thoughts. Suddenly he resented that suggestion of invasion and found he was able to break away from that odd hold, that compulsion. But to his surprise, Kitson was nodding.
"I'll buy that, Walker. I've faith in hunches. Well, it was a good thing for me that yours—"
He paused, froze into immobility, except for a gesture with one hand which held Blake as quiet. Kitson might be listening, but though Blake strained his own ears, he could hear nothing at all. A second later, there was a discreet tap at the door. Blake got up. Kitson was as still as a hunter waiting for prey to come within striking distance, but his head turned to Blake, and he shaped words with such exaggerated lip movements that the younger man could read them.
"Ask who?"
Blake went to the door. His hand dropped to the catch, but he did not release it as he asked,
"Who's there?"
"Hotel security officer."
The reply was prompt, only slightly muffled by the barrier. A hand came over his shoulder with a scrap of paper. Block letters read,
"Say, check with desk."
"Let me check with the desk," Blake called.
He flattened himself against the door. There was no objection, no answer from without. But after a moment, Blake heard the faint footfalls of someone moving away. He went back to his seat on the bed. Kitson had preempted the single comfortable chair and was gazing out into the air shaft, as if he found the brickwork beyond of absorbing interest.
"I take it that that was not the hotel, Dick?"
"No, he was not, which puts us all in a jam of sorts." Kitson took out a cigarette case, offered its contents to Blake, and snapped a lighter for them both.
"That was an attempt to discover what had happened here. Unfortunately, it means that you have now been linked with us.
and that leads to complications all around. There are good and sufficient reasons why we do not want our actions to become public. We shall have to ask you to cooperate with us. Blake stirred.
I'm just an innocent bystander. I didn't come here to play cops and robbers, and I'm not even asking what I'm mixed up in, which I believe shows some restraint on my part.
Again, Kitson smiled faintly, and Blake continued, I just want to go about my own business. Kitson tossed his hat on the desk and leaned back his black head to blow a perfect smoke ring. And we'd like nothing better than to see you do just that. But I'm afraid it's too late for second thoughts now. You should have had those before you opened your door. Others have taken an interest in you, and that might prove, at the best, embarrassing. At the worst. His eyes glinted like gemstones through the smoke, and Blake felt an odd chill, almost a suspicion of that same uneasiness which had drawn him into this adventure. Kitson was implying things, and the force of his implications was heightened by the very vagueness of his words. I see that it begins to dawn on you that this is serious. When must you report at Havers for classes?
The new term begins next Monday.
A week. I'm going to ask you to play along with us for that period. If we have any luck, this case will be settled by then, or at least your part of it will. Otherwise, I might be taken care of, for my own good and yours, Blake demanded. But he recognized the voice of authority. This man was used to giving orders, which were obeyed without question. If he said, remove Blake Walker and put him on ice, Blake Walker would be removed with the same speed and efficiency as the gunman had earlier been extracted from this room. No one ever gained by ramming a stone wall head-on. Better follow orders, at least until he could learn more about the setup.
All right, what do I do?
You vanish, here and now. How much luggage do you have? Kitson was on his feet, across the room to open the closet before Blake really understood that reply to his question.
One bag.
Something, perhaps the power of the other's personality, swept Blake into action he would not have considered an hour before. He snapped the suitcase shut and took out his wallet to count out some bills on the top of the chest.
I take it that we do not check out formally?
It was more a statement than a question, and he was not surprised as Kitson swiftly agreed. The gray light outside the window had brightened very little. It was 5 minutes after 7, but the dusk within the room was that of evening as the agent snapped off the light. Blake shrugged into his topcoat, picked up his hat and bag, ready to follow as the other beckoned him out into the hall. They did not take the turn leading to the elevator, but instead went to a fire door. Stairs, 5 floors of them, silent and deserted as the hall had been. Then Kitson paused for a moment before another door, giving the impression of listening. Down another flight of stairs, narrower, not so well lighted, threading through a place of storage compartments to more steps going up. They emerged on the open street with the chill drizzle of sleet in their faces. Blake was sure that his guide not only knew exactly where he was going, but that they had been unobserved throughout that flight. His belief in the efficiency of the agent's organization was settled for all time as a taxi came in at the curb almost as they crossed the strip of pavement. Kitson opened the door and Blake obeyed the implied order, but to his surprise, the agent did not join him. Instead, the door slammed shut and the cab pulled away. For the moment, Blake was content to follow orders and see where all this stage managing would leave him. But, as he had more time to think and was out of range of Kitson's electric personality, he was surprised at his own compliance with every suggestion the agent had made. If this wasn't some weird dream, it came very close to it. Undoubtedly, the wisest thing for him to do would be to stop this cab and disappear on his own. Only he had a very strong suspicion that Kitson would sooner or later catch up with him again, and that then their relationship would be on a far less easy footing. The taxi wove through the narrow roads in the Central Park in a shuttle pattern, which completely baffled Blake's scant knowledge of the city. Then they came out on the main streets once more. Morning traffic was on the move, and the cab rounded buses, bored between trucks and private cars. It slowed at last to whip into a narrow alley running between blank-walled buildings, which might be warehouses. About 3/4 of the way down this, the driver pulled to a stop.
Here you are.
Blake reached for his wallet, but the driver said, without turning around,
It's already paid, Mac. You go in that door, see? Elevator there. Punch the top button. Now make it snappy, Mac. This here's no place to park.
Blake went on in to be confronted by the glass-frosted panel of a self-operating elevator. He punched the top button and tried to count the floors as he moved upward creakily, but he was not sure whether they came to stop before 9 or 10. Beyond was a scrap of hall, hardly more than standing room before a single blank door. Blake knocked, and the portal opened so speedily that he thought they must have been awaiting him.
Come in, Walker.
Blake had been expecting Kitson, but the man who greeted him was the elder of the agent by at least 10 years. He was shorter, and his hair was brindled with gray threads among the dark brown, but as inconspicuous as he might have been in a crowd, there was a quiet distinction in his air. He was as much a personality in his way as the more aggressive Kitson.
I'm Jason Saxton.
He introduced himself, and Mark Kitson is waiting. Just leave your things here. Deftly separated from coat, hat, and bag, Blake was ushered into an inner office, where he found not only Kitson, but the red-haired man who had helped remove the gunman in the Shelbourne. The room was bare, except for a wall range of files, a desk, and 3 or 4 chairs. There was not even a window to break the gray walls, matched in shade by a carpet underfoot, and the lighting came from a concealed source near the ceiling. "This is Hoyt," Kitson indicated the redhead abruptly. "You made the trip without incident, I see?" Blake wanted to ask what kind of an incident Kitson had expected him to encounter, but he decided that his wisest move now was to let the other fellow do the talking. Hoyt was slumped down in his chair, his long legs stretched out, his hands, with their fringing of coarse red hairs, finger-laced across his flat middle.
"Joey knows his stuff," he observed lazily. "Stan will report if anyone showed undue interest."
"I believe you said your father was a policeman. Where? In Ohio?" Kitson paid no attention to his colleague's comment.
"In Columbus, yes, but I said my foster father," corrected Blake. He was on guard, aware that every word he spoke was being noted, weighed by all of the three fronting him.
"And your real parents?" Blake told his story in as few words as possible. Hoyt might have dozed off during that recital. His eyes were closed. Saxton gave it the courteous attention a personnel man would grant that of a job applicant, and Kitson continued to study him with those hard, amber eyes.
"That's it," he ended.
Hoyt arose in one lithe and strangely graceful movement. His eyes, now fully opened, Blake noticed, were green, as vivid in color and as compelling when he turned them on one as were Kitson's.
"I take it Walker's staying?"
he asked of the room at large. Instinctively, Blake glanced at Kitson. The final decision lay with the agent, he was sure. And on the desk, he now noticed something new. In the middle of the green blotter was a small ball of crystal. Some movement of the agent's must have disturbed it, for it began to roll toward Blake. It had almost reached the edge of the desk when he put out his hand and caught it.
Chapter 2. Its weight suggested that it was a natural crystal, but when he reached out to replace it on the desk, there was a change in it. He had caught a clear ball. What he now held was a globe in which swirled a blue-green twist of vapor. As he continued to hold it, that vapor grew more dense, thickened, until the color was solid. The change was uncanny. Blake set it down as if the ball seared his flesh. Now the blue-green was fading once more. But Saxton was on his feet, crowding forward against Hoyt to watch the transformation. Kitson's hand covered the sphere. The blue-green was gone, but had there been the beginning of another change? The agent dropped the globe into a drawer, not before Blake was certain that in a few short seconds that the other's fingers had been in contact with the crystal, an orange-red mist had begun to collect within. Before he could ask a question, a warning buzz from a plate set in the wall was an interruption. There followed the hum of the elevator, and Hoyt answered the door, admitting his small comrade of the early morning.
"Everything satisfactory?"
That was Kitson.
"Yes." The voice was light, musical. He might have been a boy hardly out of his teens, until you saw his eyes, assessed the very faint lines about his almost too well-shaped mouth. There was a tail,
that squat punk from the Crystal Bird. You'd think they wouldn't use the same men so often.
The supply of proper material may be strictly limited, suggested Saxton.
For which we should give thanks. Kitson caught him up. One raid, if we could be sure of getting all the dupes together, would put our friend out of business here.
To send him hopping.
Saxton's slow voice was clearly warning.
Better keep him on this level.
His eyes touched Blake, and he was abruptly silent. The young man who had just come in shrugged out of his coat and draped it across a chair. Roscoe isn't too bright. I left him nosing a cold trail. We needn't worry about him for an hour or so. Walker's in the clear for the time being. Kitson leaned back in his chair. That may be, but they'll backtrack on him when it dawns that he's given them the slip. He turned to Blake. Did you tell anyone at the hotel that you were going to attend classes at Haver's?
The doorman. I asked him about a bus to get out there, but he's used to questions about transportation. He must be asked 100 a day. He won't remember just one.
The others, by their expressions, did not agree with that hope.
People have a way of recalling just what you want them to forget when it is made clear to them that it is important,
Kitson remarked. We'll keep you here a couple of days until we can assess the amount of excitement your disappearance causes. That's the only way to check their interest in you. Sorry, Walker. You need not remind me that this action is undue interference in your private life. I know that as well as you do. But sometimes situations develop when innocent bystanders have to suffer for the general good. We can give you comfortable quarters, and your stay is for your own protection as well as for the safety of our investigation.
I think, Saxton got up, that our first gesture of hospitality might be to offer breakfast.
And Blake, rising to that bait readily enough, followed him through the second door in the office into an astonishing suite of rooms. The furniture was modern in monotones of gray, green, and odd, misty shades of blue. There were no pictures, and in each room the lighting came from the ceiling. A TV set of some size stood against one wall, and a great many books, papers, and current magazines were profusely scattered in piles on tables and stacks on the floor, within easy reach of each chair.
"Our quarters are a little cramped," his host informed him. "You'll have to share my sleeping accommodations, I'm afraid. In here."
He opened a door off a short hall to display a sizable room with twin beds.
"And here, breakfast awaits."
There were no windows. Blake puzzled over that as he took his place at a table, and Saxton went to the wall, pushed aside a panel, and lifted out a tray, which he put before his guest, bringing out a second for himself. It was a hearty meal, excellently prepared, and Blake enjoyed it. Saxton smiled.
"This is one of the cook's generous mornings."
He pushed aside a pile of books. They were all histories, some English and some American, and they bristled with small paper markers as if some program of intensive research was underway. Saxton indicated them.
"They represent a hobby of mine, Walker. It is also, in a manner of speaking, connected with my employment. You are perhaps yourself a student of history?"
Blake took time to think as he swallowed a bite of ham. Either he was jumpy or Saxton had purpose behind this line of conversation.
"My foster father collected books on criminal history, famous trials, things like that. I read those, and diaries and letters, Pepys eyewitness accounts."
Saxton held his coffee cup poised, studying it as if it had suddenly turned into a precious bit of antique china.
"Eyewitness reports. Just so. Tell me, have you ever heard of the possibility worlds theory of history? I've read some fantasy fiction founded on that.
You mean that idea that two complete worlds stem from every momentous historical decision? One in which Napoleon won the Battle of Waterloo, say, and our own in which he lost it?"
"Yes. There would be myriad worlds, all influenced by various decisions, not only by the obvious ones of battles and political changes, but even by the appearance and use of certain inventions. A fascinating supposition."
Blake nodded. Sure, the idea was interesting, and it was manifestly Saxton's hobby horse, but at the present moment he was more absorbed by the predicament of one Blake Walker and his possibility worlds.
"There are points of departure even within the past few years,"
the man across the table was continuing.
"Conceive a world in which Hitler won the Battle of Britain and overran England in 1941.
Suppose a great leader is born too early or too late. Blake's interest was sparked.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?